All right, welcome back to Whence Came You, a Freemasonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. I'm your host, Brother Robert Johnson. This is episode 112. All right, the news for this week, I finished reading Holy Blood, Holy Grail, on recommendation of Brother Rob Lewis, and wow, my mind was blown twice over. There were some ups, some downs, some things I agreed with, some things I didn't agree with, but overall, pretty good read. But being in Templary kind of made it seem more palatable, and it made a little bit more sense, I think, than it may make to some people who aren't involved in Templary. My state lodge, the Grand Lodge of Illinois, is having its Grand Lodge sessions in a week or so. I'll be attending that, and I have a pretty packed schedule. I even have a meeting with the Midnight Freemasons. We're going to meet up and hang out, and I'm pretty excited. I'm really looking forward to it. I have a little project I'm working on for Todd Creason and his new book. More on that as it comes to light, and most likely at Brother Todd's leisure, when he decides to put it out there, when he's ready to do that. So we're going to go ahead and jump right into this week's piece, entitled Masonic Blue, which is a short talk bulletin, volume 12, July 1934. Number 7. And you may realize that a lot of times I like these short talk bulletins because they're not really long. I like to keep the papers on the shorter side if possible. And you'll also realize that I read a lot of them that are older. I read a lot of them that are older because I think there are some interesting ideas portrayed in those early years in the 1920s and 30s that are very relevant to today. So I think it's interesting to brothers of today, new Master Masons will realize that the things that mattered then still matter today. In essence, Freemasonry hasn't changed, even though it's always changing, if that makes any sense. Anyway, on with the paper. Masonic Blue, Short Talk Bulletin, and again, by unknown. The inquirer who asks why the ancient craft masonry is blue. Why speak of blue lodge, blue degrees, wear aprons edged with blue, suspend jewels about the necks of officers with blue ribbons, is faced at once with two divergent schools of thought. One of these is the practical, hard-headed, founded on facts school of Masonic historian and antiquary. The other is that which associates ideas with objects, colors, numbers, beasts, birds, natural phenomena, etc., as symbolism has been developed and followed throughout the history of mankind. Historians both Masonic and secular agree that the square has been a symbol of rectitude, honesty, fair dealing, justice the world over for unknown ages. But the symbolist, who reads much into the familiar square apron with the triangular flap, is at once confronted with the undoubted fact that this form of apron is modern, not ancient. The invention of the square as a tool must have been coincident with the first appreciation of the right angle, and the advantages in solidity and ease of construction of the use of stones and timbers which were squared. Its symbolism, therefore, goes back to the time immemorial. Masonic aprons used by operative masons were simple skins of any shape, or no particular shape. With the change from operative to speculative, the apron became conventionalized. But only in comparatively recent times did it assume its present rectangular and triangular features. The symbolism read into the present shape will not fit, for instance, the aprons worn by George Washington, which had curved flaps and rounded corners. Blue, as the color of ancient craft masonry, is accounted for by two schools of thought on its origin. Both can adduce considerable evidence. One believes that the symbolism of that color, like that of the square, comes to us from time immemorial, and that the color must have been adopted because of its meanings. The other demonstrates that blue as a Masonic color is not as old as the Mother Grand Lodge, and that it was adopted for other than symbolic reasons. Blue was a sacred color to the priests of Israel. The color is mentioned first in the Old Testament, in Exodus 25:3-4, in which the Lord commands Moses to speak to the children of Israel, quote, "And this is the offering which ye shall take of gold and silver and brass and blue and purple and scarlet and fine linen and goat's hair," end quote. Throughout Exodus and Numbers are many references to the color, and several are to be found in Chronicles, Esther, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel. We read of the fine twined linens, make them ephod of golden blue, bind the breastplates with a lace of blue, pomegranates of blue, needlework of blue, a cloth wholly of blue, etc. Perhaps the most interesting allusion is in Numbers 15:37, 38, 39, and 40. Quote, "And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Speak unto the children of Israel, and bid them, that they make them fringes in the borders of their garments throughout their generations, and that they put upon the fringe of the borders of riband of blue. And it shall be unto you for a fringe, that ye may look upon it, and remember all the commandments of the Lord, and do them, and that ye seek not after your own heart and your eyes, after which ye use to go whoring, that ye may remember and do all my commandments, and be holy unto God." End quote. Mackey notes that the blue of the Old Testament is a translation of the Hebrew word, which is derived from the root signifying perfection. He develops the idea that blue was anciently and universally sacred as follows. Quote, "Among the Druids, blue was the symbol of truth and the candidate. In the initiation into the sacred rites of Druidism, was invested with a robe composed of the colors white, blue, and green. The Egyptians esteemed blue as a sacred color, and the body of Am, the principal god of their theology, was painted light blue to imitate, as Wilkinson remarks, his peculiarly exalted and heavenly nature. The ancient Babylonians clothed their idols in blue, as we learn from the prophet Jeremiah. The Chinese, in their mystical philosophy, represented blue as the symbol of the deity, because being, as they say, composed of black and red, this color is a fit representation of the obscure and brilliant, the male and the female, or active and passive principles. The Hindus assert that their god, Vishnu, was represented by a celestial sky, or blue, thus indicating that wisdom emanating from God was to be symbolized by this color. Among the medieval Christians, blue was sometimes considered as an emblem of immortality, as red was of the divine love. Portal says that blue was the symbol of perfection, hope, and constancy. The color of the celebrated dome azure was in divine language the symbol of eternal truth, in consecrated language of immortality, and in profane which Masons strive. Our ancient brethren met on hills and in vales, over which the blue vault of heaven is a ceiling. Jacob in his wisdom saw the ladder ascending from earth to heaven. The covering of a lodge is the clouded canopy or starry-decked heaven. These allusions seem to connote that blue, the color of the sky, is that of all celestial attributes for which Masons strive. Man's earliest forms of worship were the sun and fire. The sun rose, traveled, and set in the realm of blue. To associate the color with deity was inevitable. Blue also is the color of the ocean, of mountain streams, of lakes, of good drinking water. That blue should also become emblematical of purity is equally natural. In heraldry, blue or azure signifies chastity, loyalty, and fidelity. In painting, the color is frequently used in emblematical manner, as in depicting an angel's robe and the robe of the Virgin Mary to signify humility, fidelity, and especially faith. It is the color of hope. It has been held to signify eternity and immortality. Pale blue is a especially associated with peace. Of 47 nations, 27 have blue in their flags, all doubtless with the same thought that Brother Wilbur D. Nesbitt so beautifully expressed, "Your flag and my flag." And how it flies today in your land and my land and half a world away. Rose red and blood red, the stripes forever gleam, snow white and soul white, the good forefathers dream. Sky blue and true blue, with stars to gleam aright, the glorious guidance of the day, a shelter through the night. There seem to be many grounds on which he can firmly stand who believes that Freemasonry adopted blue as the color of these degrees with its ancient symbolism in mind. It is to be remembered that Freemasonry as we know it was not formed overnight by any one group of men, each of whom contributed some idea to its ritual, ceremonies, ancient usages, and customs. No committee sat about the table to decide the question, "What color shall we adopt, by which the ancient craft shall forevermore be distinguished?" Is it possible, of course, that the ancient operative Masons from whose guilds and organizations modern Freemasonry came as a result of slow evolution may have had a special reverence for the color blue? As has been noted, blue has been associated from early times in ecclesiastical history with the Virgin Mary. The earliest document, Freemasonry, the Regis poem, 1390, has two lines. "Pray we now to God Almight and His Mother, Mary Bright," which certainly connotes a reverence of these ancient Freemasons for Mary the Mother and may easily be considered ground for thinking that the early builders also revered her special color. However, that may be, it is obvious that the absence of any evidence is not negative evidence. It is commonplace of human experience that in the face of any positive evidence for an idea, in the absence of any evidence against it, the fact should be admitted. All of which brings us to what we know of the earliest use of the blue as Masonic color, regardless of how much we may wish that our forefathers had adopted blue for the symbolism we are now content to read into the hue of heaven. Two extracts from the minutes of the Grand Lodge of England in 1717 are explicit upon the matter of color. Quote, "Resolved that in private lodges and quarterly communications and general meetings, the masters and wardens do wear jewels of masonry hanging to a white ribbon, that the master wear the square, the senior wardens the level, and the junior warden the plum rule." Grand Lodge Minutes, 24th of June, 1727. Quote, "Dr. Desaguliers, taking notice of some irregularities in wearing the marks of distinction which have been allowed by former Grand Lodges, proposed that none but the Grand Master, his deputy wardens, shall wear their jewels in gold or gilt, pendant to blue ribbons about their necks, and white leather aprons lined with blue silk. That all those who have served any of the three grand offices shall wear the like aprons lined with blue silk in all lodges and assemblies of masons where they appear clothed, that all masters and wardens of lodges may wear their aprons lined with white silk and their respective jewels with plain white ribbons, but of no other color whatsoever." Quote, "The deputy grand master accordingly put the question whether the above regulation should be agreed to, and it was carried into the affirmative." Grand Lodge Minute, 17th of March, 1731. But why did the Grand Lodge adopt or permit blue in 1731 when white was specified just 4 years previously? Passing over the common but wholly coincidental reason that many taverns where Masons met were distinguished by blue signs, such as the Blue Boar. The Sanset theory seems to be that proposed by the noted Masonic scholar Fred J.W. Crow. He wrote, 1909 and 1910, Lodge of Research Transactions, quote, "The color of the Grand Lodge officers' clothing was adopted from the ribbon of the most noble order of the Garter, the Grand Stewards from the Second National Order, the most honorable order of the Bath. The Scottish Grand Lodge undoubtedly copied the ribbon of the most ancient and most noble order of the Thistle, and the Grand Lodge of Ireland anticipated the formation of the most illustrious order of St. Patrick in 1788 by selecting light blue, thus accidentally completing the series, although I would suggest that light blue may in all probability have been chosen merely to mark a difference from the English Grand Lodge. In a like manner, I believe that light blue of our own private lodge clothing was, by natural sequence of ideas, adopted to contrast with the deeper color of Grand Lodge attire, and not very long after, the last name became the rule." Alright, it's time to pay the bills. Check out our smartphone apps, which give you streaming access to the show as well as the papers that we read on the show via PDF, and also Masonic wallpapers for your mobile device, all once a week. Also, if you're on Stitcher Smart Radio, we're on there as well. If you aren't on Stitcher Smart Radio, then you can download it for free and register for free, and you use the promo code WhenceCameYou with no spaces, which sends the show $1 and it costs you nothing. We do have an affiliate with Onnit Labs, and they make some great supplements that benefit cognitive function and also great other nutritional supplements. Just click the link on our site and it will take you to the Onnit shop. And when you click through Onnit, it sends a few bucks from the sale to us here at the show, and it keeps the lights on. Also, if you use the promo code WCY at checkout, it will take 10% off of your order, and that's usually the shipping, maybe a little bit more. If apps and supplements aren't your thing, and you do want to help the show out, we do have a donation button which is run through PayPal, and it's totally secure. All the money raised goes right into the production of the show, and it makes it available in its entirety at all times. Instead of having just, say, the last 10 episodes or so, all the episodes are actually available all the time. So when you go on iTunes, some shows only have like the last 10, 15 episodes. Sometimes on Stitcher, it's the only last 3 episodes. Our show is all 100 and up to now 112 episodes. All of them are always available all the time. Speaking of donations, I have to give a little shout out to Brother James McCraw for his donation. I thank you, and I sent you a little something as well for the generosity, brother, so I hope it finds you well. Speaking now of generous brothers, Brother Merv Romeo down under, thank you so much for your offer. As many of you know, for a donation of $4, I will send you any episode on the CD. Brother Merv offered to help out by taking care of any orders that come from that part of the world, down in Australia. And he did that in order to save the show on shipping. It's so generous, and I thank you so much. So if you're in the States or Canada, $4 gets you whatever episode you want. And if you're down under, they will come from Brother Merv, most likely. So I haven't read anything from the California Freemason magazine in a bit, and they have some great new material. So next is a short piece from the February 2013 issue, and the article is called Lighting the Way. Through innovation and engineering greatness, three Freemasons shaped the world as we know it, by Tanya Rowan. Imagine a world without standard time zones, Nevada without the Hoover Dam, on your daily life without a PC, the internet, or Wikipedia. Thanks to three famous Freemasons, you don't have to. Perhaps their Masonic journey inspired them to seek inventive solutions, or maybe guidance from their fraternal peers helped them make their visions a reality. Whatever influence Freemasonry had on their achievements, the fact remains the innovations of Sanford Fleming, Vannevar Bush, and Lester Allen Pelton helped shape the modern world. Father of Standard Time. Today, Montreal and Toronto fall within the same time zone, but back in 1884, there was a 13-minute time difference between the two cities. That's because each municipality set its clocks according to the sun's local position, a method of timekeeping that worked well before the Industrial Revolution, but that proved totally unmanageable with the advent of railway and telegraph systems. That's where Sanford Fleming comes in. From designing Canada's first postage stamp, the Three-Penny Beaver, to advocating the construction of the submarine cable that would connect all of the British Empire, Fleming's technological contributions were varied in scope and far-reaching in geography. Born in Scotland in 1827, Fleming moved to Canada in his late teens. There, he worked as an engineer overseeing the construction of some of Canada's most vital rail lines. Through this work, Fleming observed that the current system of timekeeping hindered the entire infrastructure. Scheduling was unnecessarily complicated, and passengers traveling from one city to another had to reset their clocks at every stop, in minute increments. Fleming came up with a solution, Universal Standard Time. According to his method, the world was divided into 24 time zones, each one covering 15 degrees of longitude, and neighboring zones differentiating by 1 hour. It was an elegant solution to a complicated problem, but it would take some time and a lot of work before it was universally accepted. Fleming was up to the challenge. He traveled around the world to explain and promote his idea at meetings and conferences, and since he was a Freemason at St. Andrew's Lodge No. 1, York, now St. Andrew's Lodge No. 16, he was also able to draw upon the support of powerful members of the Brotherhood, like Canada's 4th Governor General, John Campbell. His request, though long, was successful. By 1929, most of the world had adopted Universal Standard Time. Visions of the future. The next time you load up on your favorite website, consider for a moment that its very structure is based on the work of an early 20th century engineer. To call Vannevar Bush an overachiever would be an understatement. Born in 1890, Bush's ingenuity and capacity for leadership shone through from an early age. In high school, he was vice president of his sophomore class and president of his junior class. He went on to study engineering at Tufts College near Boston, where he earned both his bachelor's and his master's degree in 4 years. For his master's thesis, he developed and patented the profile tracer, which was used in surveying to calculate distances over uneven ground. Later, he earned his doctorate in engineering at MIT. He was also a Master Mason and served as Master of Richard C. McLaren Lodge in Cambridge, Massachusetts. The profile tracer was the first of many innovations for Bush, who designed and patented 46 inventions over the course of his career. Bush's best-known achievement was his differential analyzer, an analog computer that could solve complex differential equations through drive shafts and gears. It was used to calculate the ballistics table during World War II. Bush is also widely heralded for a groundbreaking article he penned for the Atlantic Monthly in As We May Think. Bush envisioned a futuristic device called a Memex, in which people could store books, records, and communications all interconnected by associative trails. The Memex linking system was the inspiration for hyperlink texts that we now see online. In the same article, Bush predicted the emergence of the internet, personal computers, online encyclopedias, and voice recognition technology, a powerful discovery. Every year, nearly a million people tour the Hoover Dam. This hydroelectric power plant on the border between Nevada and Arizona generates 4.2 billion kilowatt hours annually, supplying power across three states. The dam is probably America's most famous hydroelectric plant, but it is by no means the only one. Hydropower is one of the world's most widely used renewable energy sources. And if it weren't for an accidental observation by a California Mason, Lester Allen Pelton, in the 1870s, it might not exist. Pelton was born in Ohio in 1829, but moved to California during the gold rush with dreams of making it in the mines, but instead earned his living as a fisherman and carpenter. Still, his interest in gold mining and the technologies it leveraged remained. At the time, there was a need for new power sources to run mining machinery. Steam power was one of the most pervasive, but it required large amounts of wood and coal. Water power provided an attractive alternative, but The turbines of the era were highly inefficient. Then one day, while Pelton, then a millwright, was watching a turbine in action, something unexpected happened. A piece had come loose from the machine, misaligning the wheel and redirecting its water flow. Surprisingly, this caused the turbine to spin faster and more efficiently. Pelton took his findings and set about designing the best water turbine the world had ever seen. In 1880, he received his first patent for the Pelton Runner, which reached over 90% efficiency. Its predecessors were only about 40% efficient. His invention became the standard turbine upon which all future designs were based, and paved the way for the massive turbines we see today. In 1929, the brothers of Gravel Range Lodge No. 59, the same lodge Pelton once called his own, erected a monument in Camptonville to honor his memory and invention. A side note to the article is called Cooking with Technology. From world-famous brothers to everyday masons, innovations and contributions by members of the craft spanned the technology spectrum. John Logan Parsons was a Midwesterner who gained engineering expertise while in the Naval Academy. Born in Missouri, Parsons designed bakeries for Kroger grocery stores before coming to San Jose, California for a job as Safeway's engineering manager. Parsons' work at Safeway helped improve the efficiency, quality control, and sanitation standards of the grocer's chain bakeries across the United States. His redesign of a plant in Richmond resulted in the facility becoming one of the country's most technologically advanced. A high-level automation at the plant minimized handling and exposure of baking ingredients, while a new layout improved the efficiency by reducing the size of the production line. A dedicated mason for nearly 50 years, Parsons was a member of Palo Alto Roller Lodge No. 346. He came from a family of Freemasons dating all the way back to the 1700s. Though he died in 2003, his Masonic legacy continues today through his grandson, John L. Parsons III, a member of Peninsula Lodge No. 168 in Redwood City. All right. Next is this week's famous Freemason, and I know we just covered a few there in that article, but we have so many that we can really afford to be a little liberal about how many we do in a show. So in this one, we have Harry M. Warner. Who is Harry M. Warner? Focus on the last name, Warner. He's a film producer and co-founder of Warner Brothers. He was a member of Mount Olive Lodge, number 506 in California. Harry Morris Warner, born December 12, 1881, and he passed away July 25, 1958, was a Polish-born American studio executive, one of the founders of Warner Brothers, and a major contributor to the development of the film industry. Along with his three brothers, Albert, Sam, and Jack, Warner played a crucial role in the film business and played a key role in establishing Warner Brothers Pictures Incorporated, serving as the company's president until 1956. When Warner passed away, Warner had passed away in 1958 from a cerebral occlusion. He was entombed at Home of Peace Cemetery in the same mausoleum as Charles Vitter. For his contributions to the motion picture industry, Harry Warner has a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame at 6441 Hollywood Boulevard. Alright, we have some great things coming out as usual in the next few weeks on the Midnight Freemasons blog, and if you haven't heard, the Midnight Freemasons will be featured monthly in the Working Tools magazine by Brother Corey Sigler. I can't wait, and we're all very excited to get started. Please go over and check out Brother Juan Sepulveda's podcast, The Winding Stairs. He's just released another new episode. It's fantastic. He has a great interview there. Also, check out the Far From Centered podcast with Brother Rob Lewis. New episodes are coming. That's it for this week. Remember to find us on Facebook and follow on Twitter. Check us out on every other social network that there is. You can find us on Google Plus at the email address wcypodcast@gmail.com. Likewise, you can contact me about anything at that email address. You have a question about masonry, something you want me to cover. Maybe you want to be a guest on the show. Maybe you have something that you would like us to read. Maybe you're not a mason yet and you want to be a mason. You have some questions. Shoot me an email. Don't forget to check out all of our Masonic businesses like PB&J Water. Don't forget about the bookstore featuring all the books by our friends and guests of the show. Take care, and we'll talk to you all next week. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson.